Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to actor and director Tony Marden about his forthcoming feature, The Witches of the Sands, which is, wait for it, the world's first postmodern folk horror southeastern gothic blood-drenched existential B-movie. So there you go. Over the course of the interview, you will hear how Tony gathered his all-star cast, which includes such horror luminaries as Deep Breath, Linnea Quigley, Lloyd Kaufman, Michael St. Michael, Eileen Dietz, Brink Stevens, Giovanni Bardo Radici, and Lynn Lowry, plus a whole lot more. And how it's been going filming-wise, given all the current restrictions we all have in the world. Plus, we talk about how this is likely to be his only feature as a director, what his major horror influences are, and what makes a good horror comedy. Oh yeah, I also randomly, inadvertently inspire some extra content for the film. So yeah, that's weird. Anyway, all of which you can hear right now in my interview with Tony. Hi Tony, welcome to New Horror Express.
Hey, how you doing? Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on.
So
we have you on to talk about a number of things, but one of those things is your upcoming film, The Witches of the Sands. So can you give a spoiler-free synopsis of The Witches of the Sands?
Okay, so it's I suppose the best way I can describe it is this: is we follow two kind of narratives. We follow the director of a B-movie who is also called Tony, not myself, and he is making this film called The Witches of the Sands, and he is not the nicest of people. He's not the nicest director. He's a bit of an arse, and as the film progresses, his life deteriorates and starts maybe to mirror a little bit about what's going on in the film he's making. And the other narrative is the character Fisher Marquardt, who is the character of the film that he's making. So we follow the director, and then we the narrative, and we follow Fisher's character, who is a part of the film he's making. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah. So Fisher is a really sort of crappy paranormal investigator. And he's got a pretty dire podcast, and he's kind of passionate about it, and he gets lured then to this town to look at the death of someone who might be connected with the occult, and he thinks, well, I'm going to get involved with that. I might be able to find some sort of paranormal clues for my podcast. He's going to try to get one up on the other sort of paranormal investigators who are his competition, and a bit Wicker Man in places, but then it isn't. And then we've got that sort of narrative runs next to the director's narrative while he's making it, and then we've got these kind of meta kind of postmodern areas where we've got a lot of stars, I suppose, from horror films like Linnea Quigley, Brink Stevens, Brandon Crane from It, and Michael St. Michael's from The Greasy Strangler, which is one of my favorite films of the last God knows how many years. Barbara Manolfi from Suspiria, lots of loads of people, Giovanni from house near to the park, and Cannibal Ferox, etc. Yeah, exactly. And so we've got these characters who kind of pop up doing specific things throughout the film. Essentially, it's kind of the film I would want to watch as a horror film fan. It's a kind of love letter to fans. I don't think that gives too much away. It's a bizarre little film. And there's a lot of little sort of nuances and little things I take from things I remember watching from my childhood. So, for example, one of the things I remember is The Beast Must Die, where they have the werewolf break. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that film with Peter Cushing.
I do know the film, but I have not seen it. I know of the film, so I'm aware.
So it's a kind of werewolf whodunit, and then towards the end there's a werewolf break where you know there's a minute to guess who the werewolf is. So I'm trying to use some of this sort of audience participation and showmanship, a bit like William Castle with like the Tingler and House on Haunted Hill as well and stuff like that. There's a lot of addressing the audience as well as the narratives that are going on. So what I didn't want, what I wanted was a lot of people, a lot of well-known faces in the film. But I wanted them there for a specific reason. What I sometimes find when I'm watching a film it's a film that came out a couple of years ago, I won't mention it, but had a lot of genre stars in it, but didn't really do much with them, if that makes sense. They're just kind of there to fill time and to be names, whereas everyone who's in Witches of the Sands is there for a specific reason. The scene was written specifically for them in connection with like a film they've been in or what they're kind of best known for. So some of it's quite comedic, some of it's quite unpleasant. If you're a horror film fan, you'll pick up on a lot more in the film than if you're not. I mean, there's enough in the film, you know, if you don't know these people, if you don't know their films, there's enough in it. But as I say, it's a love letter to horror film fans who are going to pick up on certain, dialogue or something in the background or costume or something that will have them thinking, oh yeah, that reminds me of blah blah blah, but at the same time, so I am rambling now, but at the same time, it's quite an original film. It's original in its execution, I think. I hope. That's kind of where Witches of the Sands is, which, incidentally, the Witches of the Sands abbreviates quite nicely to TWOTS. which I didn't realise when I named it. Then I wrote it down and I looked at it, it's like TWOTS. Which kind of, again, works really nicely with the film, because we're just fans of TWOTS, really, now. It's quite funny and relevant. So that's kind of where we are. There's a lot of homage to my favourite films, I suppose.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, where the initial idea of, like, where that came from. It says you co-wrote the film with Deborah Lamb. That's correct.
Well, I wrote the film. Deborah, right. I got in touch with Deborah, and she had an idea for her scene, based on an idea I had. So she co-wrote one scene with me.
Okay, but you wrote the majority of the screen.
I wrote the rest. Yeah, the idea actually came from another filmmaker, Sam Mason Bell, independent filmmaker, British filmmaker, got in touch with me and said, look, do you want to do a 15-minute short? We're going to do an anthology. It's got to be a ghost story, a ghost hunter, paranormal investigation taking place over 3 nights, found footage. And I said, yeah, okay. But from then there, that's how it started. And then it started getting a bit bigger and bigger. My friend Brandon Crane, he played Ben Hanscom in the It miniseries, mm-hmm. and then he guested in It Chapter 2. And he said, well, I'll give me to anything. I was like, yeah, that'd be great. So he did a little bit for me. And then from there, other things started happening. And then it turned out that Sam didn't have the enough people involved to make the film he wanted to make. So he said, let's go for, carry on doing what you're doing. So from there, it went from a 15-minute short. Then I think Brandon got involved. And then Eileen Dietz from The Exorcist, I approached her. And then Michael from Greasy Strangler. And then the more things, that it was very organic in its process. I was writing it as I went along, I think. So it started off as Fisher, you know, in this ghost hunting story, which, you know, had this kind of premise as almost a bit of a joke. The idea was going to be 10 minutes, quite a jokey film, and then a really hard hitting, quite unpleasant ending, which is still all in the film, but with it's obviously been a lot more going on now as well. So that's how it started. And then the more people that got involved, the more I was writing, the more I wanted to include. So when people like, then I asked people like Linnea Quigley, because I absolutely love Return of the Living Dead. And she got involved along with Beverly Randolph, who was played Tina in Return of the Living Dead. And then that kind of scene wrote itself. And then other little sequences, little meta postmodern bits and pieces cropping up. The scene with Brandon Crane is really funny, I think it is. You know, when you think something's funny and other people might not, but I hope it is. And the scene with Eileen Dietz is very funny as well. But then there's a lot of sort of unpleasantness to it as well. It's a kind of psychological. When you look at this director, Tony, and his sort of psychological journey, you know, from someone who's, you know, a bit of a dick to someone who becomes, you know, the worst person ever. It just kept writing itself. And then I get messages from people saying, oh, you know, so-and-so would like to be in your film, or blah, blah, blah. Lynn Lowry said, you know, so from, you know, Romero's Crazies and Cronenberg's Shivers. Yeah. And so I messaged her right at the beginning, and then and she said, oh, she couldn't do it at the time. Then after a while, she got in touch with me again, saying, you know, is this thing I can do? I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then she's got an amazing scene that she filmed in the States. This ties in so brilliantly. I can't really tell you anything about it because it will give away one of the kind of big plot twists. Okay. But I should mention, actually, what you mentioned, Deborah Lamb. Deborah Lamb was absolutely amazing. She flew somewhere. She filmed in Philadelphia, her scene. And she was only flying over there anyway to do something else. But then someone else got involved as well, called Mark Bonacore, one of her friends, is the director. And they somehow managed between them to somehow film this amazing scene. You know, so I've got knights and, you know, in full armor and in this sort of flashback scene to like the first Witch of the Sands. And it turns out, you know, and Deborah's, and this was all filmed very gothic, very much like a Hammer film, which is exactly how I wanted it. So if you can imagine, you know, witch in, you know, the opening of a Hammer film with a witch, or like, kind of looks, you know, like a typical kind of peasant woman walking through the forest, but then you see her sort of doing this incantation, all of a sudden these knights appear, and it's pretty amazing. And so I think what I'm saying is that without all the love of these people, it would have been a different story, you know. It would have been a very different film. So there's so much going on. We covered something else the other day as well, which we've just been filming, where as I say, we've got the Fisher character in the film and Tony, who's directing the film, and they've both got different kind of voiceovers, if that makes sense, different people doing voiceovers for the different narrative stream. And there's one point where the film gets a little bit confusing, and then and what happens is the voiceover artists start getting confused with who they're voiceovering, and you get this sort of really, really fun, sort of bizarre, confused dialogue between the two voiceover artists, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense or not. It's just a little bit, it's a bit of fun, but it's, I don't know, hopefully, like I say, I'm hoping to offer something a little bit different, maybe.
And so it was just, you just kind of reached out to everybody who was involved, and they just happened to agree.
Pretty much. There were a couple of people I paid, but the majority of people did it free for me. So I have no technical ability, you know. So I've got, but through my acting, I've got to know quite a few people in the industry. So I'm really lucky in that literally over the road, I can see his house from here, is a guy called Matt, who's a director and special effects, does a lot of visual effects. So I roped him in, and he's just done some amazing stuff. He, you know, he animated the gorillas on their first tour, and I don't know if you remember that Domestos advert, Kills All Known Germs Dead. You know, this big germs coming, but the way he was responsible for some of those germs. So, so I had these great visual effects from him. I've got great editors who you know Alex and Michael from Ice Cream on the Beach. They're editing it. I've got great cinematographers, Andy Boothby, and some others. And you know, it just the list goes on and on. These people who I've been lucky enough to work with before, who've kind of volunteered their services. I would say Matt's quite unlucky, because he literally lives, you know, about 7 meters from my house. So it's like there's literally no escape for him. So he's done some amazing visuals. A lot of it is practical effect, because I love practical effects. You know, I love being able to make it myself, or see it, or feel it, and touch it, and stuff. But some of it just lends itself more to CGI, and the work he's done is phenomenal, absolutely amazing. It's crazy to think that it's gone from this little 15-minute film to something a lot bigger. We'll see.
Was that
what
stressful at all? You know, like it's having that kind of thing of like, oh, I'm making it. You know, you have an idea in your head. I'm making a 15-minute film. I'm now making a feature. I'm making my first feature.
Yeah. Well, there's a definite naivety about because I ummed and ahed about doing the 15-minute at first, I had this, I had an idea, I thought, yeah, I'll do it, definitely. And Sam said, well, I can help with the editing, you know. I said, great, that's great, because I love directing this. One of my, you know, I absolutely adore directing it, and I love writing it, I love acting, but anything more technical than that, I want other people to do it for me. And it sounds very diva-ish, but I can't do it. You know, if I could do it, I'd do it, but I can't. And so I had these ideas for different angles and different shots and how I want things to look. And I try and explain it the best I can, and other people then get on board. But yeah, sorry. It's very scary. And I have no right to do it as well, I don't think. I don't really know how I'm doing it without. I've just kind of gone in the deep end, and I suppose that's how I work best. You know, whatever I'm doing, if there's a bit of pressure, then I'm okay. You know, I kind of have to. Well, the thing is, now I've got to get on with it. It's 50% shot, and I've got to get it done. It is stressful. And my wife will back this up. It's like it doesn't leave you. It's always in my head. It's always something to think about. And production-wise, being a producer of it, being the producer of a 15-minute short, well, I'm kind of the only person who'd be in it, it isn't a problem. But being a producer of something where suddenly you've got sort of 15, 16 well-known horror actors, and you've got a cast probably of over 100 now, and you've got these ideas, these massive scenes. I'm writing my Indiegogo campaign, and I've got a... You know, then there's been lockdown, which has been a nightmare for it. And all of a sudden, I'm struggling to think or consider other things. It's become a little bit overwhelming, which hasn't been great. But you know, I don't. You know, it's just is what it is. It's a process. You know, it's a process. And I hate being a producer. I hate it. I hate it with a passion. I don't want to do it. if I could find someone to do it for me, then I would. Okay. Put me in front of the camera, writing it, or direct, you know, pointing the camera, or telling someone where to point the camera. I love it. But, you know, finding locations and trying to find money. And
so hopefully if you do a second feature, you won't be the producer.
I won't.
You can find somebody else.
Let me tell you, I am never doing another feature film. Unless someone says to me, let's say, for example, this makes a little bit of money, And I'm under no illusions, you know, that, you know, these small independent films probably won't make any money. Mm-hmm. Unless someone says to me, here's 100 grand, make a film. I'm never doing it again, ever, ever. Because
you'll be like Charles Lawton. You'll just be like one and done.
Exactly. I can write, I direct and I would act in it all day long. But anything more than that is, you know, this is it. This is my magnum opus. This is why I'm chucking as much as I can into it. I think it's, you know, we've got clowns and dolls and witches and flying demons and nuns and, you know, I just, it's like,
you know, you're covering all your exploitation genre bases.
Yeah, exactly. I've got new druids. I've got, you know, it's like, I've got knights. I've got Excalibur. You know, it's just the craziest little film. I suppose, you know, it's like a trauma film, you know. It's going to be a love or hate, I think. You know, like The Greasy Strangler, like Toxic Avenger, it's that sort of film, I think, you know, that sort of excess. There are some poignant moments, you know, there are some issues, you know, there's some mental health issues it talks about, there's some, well, very much so, but that's there if you want to see it. If you don't want to see it, you don't have to. You know, it's not rammed home, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose with those films as well that you mentioned, it's kind of the same. Of like, lots of trauma films have like some social commentary of sorts, and even The Greasy Strangler has a kind of father-son relationship at the heart of it. Yeah, it's a weird version, but like
absolutely, and like stuff. Absolutely does. It's exactly the root of the film, isn't it? And and trauma, you know, trauma films have huge social commentary, like you say, running through a lot of them. So, you know, there's, I suppose, I haven't set out to emulate a trauma film, though, or The Greasy Strangler. You know, I've just set out, all I'm doing is making the film that I want to make. And actually, Michael St. Michaels from, you know, The Greasy Strangler, he said, he was talking about Jim Hosking, the director of Greasy Strangler, and he said, I'm just going to make the film I want to make, you know, and that's what I'm doing. If one person likes it, great, you know, if 10 people like it, better, you know, I don't know. I'm being really selfish, and I'm literally making it for myself. I'm not trying to please people. I'm hoping people will enjoy it, you know. But I think, you know, it's like writing a book. You write a book for yourself. You write the book you want to write. You know, if you're true to the spirit of it. If you want to write a bestseller, I'm sure you can write a bestseller. But if you want to write a book that means something to you, you write it for yourself. You don't try and please other people. I think that's where I am, I think, with this. And I'm hoping that, you know, some people will enjoy it. I think they will. And I think a lot of horror fans will enjoy it. I think there's enough to offer people, but I think there will be people who don't like it. In the same people like, you know, The Greasy Strangler or whatever film, you know, that offers something a little bit different. I keep talking about The Greasy Strangler because I bloody love it. But
The Greasy Strangler is a great film. I really enjoy that film as well. Because Michael St. Michael from The Greasy Strangler is in your film. How is he to work with? I've seen him in The Greasy Strangler. There was also a guy I interviewed in the podcast called Juan Ortiz in his film Fingers. He was in that as well. And, you know, obviously he seems like an intense character.
he's really nice. He's lovely. He's I was chatting to him. He was in his flat in LA, and he's just a really nice bloke. He's got a lot of funny stories. He used to be a hairdresser, interestingly, in his younger days.
I think Juan did tell me that.
And obviously he's very well coiffed himself, isn't he? You know,
yes, he is.
He's got a fine head of hair.
Fine head of hair, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah, but no, he's lovely. He's lovely. Barbara Manolfi's lovely. Deborah's lovely. Dawn is lovely. Brandon, who I've known anyway, had a couple of night out with Brandon. He's a lovely guy. Everyone actually has been really, really lovely. A lot of people have stayed in touch. Linnea was great. She bent over backwards to help. I don't want to miss her. I've started talking. I'm mentioning names. It's awkward.
And I feel like Lloyd's in the Lloyd's in the film.
Lloyd's lovely. Lloyd's got a really funny scene actually. Again, another little meta scene.
I do like on IMDb that he's credited as producer of distinguished horror films and cleaner, so which kind of suggests it's a funny scene.
It is. I mean, one of his lines.
Don't spoil anything.
No,
we'll keep it.
Basically, he has to do a bit of cleaning up, and he's not happy about it. And he does shout for Melvin at one point, which is quite cool, and. he's lovely, and I'm hoping that we can use some of the Troma characters as well in an animated sequence, which would be amazing. So I've got quite a bit of animation in the film as well, because I love animation.
It's funny because a little while ago I interviewed Lloyd, and I said that my first interaction with Troma was when I was about 7 years old, and I caught Toxic Crusaders on the
fantastic. It's a great series actually. It's hard.
Yeah, you know, I loved it as a kid. I bought some of the action figures and everything. That was my gateway to Troma, and then I didn't realize what it was based on until years later, and I was like, this got turned into a cartoon.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's bizarre, isn't it? How did that happen? You know, it's like it's just the weirdest thing. But
that was just a weird thing that happened. In I was born in 1985, and so in the kind of late 80s and 90s, there seemed to be this weird thing where these violent films would get made into cartoons. So I remember there was a Conan cartoon, a RoboCop cartoon. It
Rambo,
doesn't happen now.
There's a Rambo, I think.
There was a Rambo cartoon. Yeah. Just they made these really violent films into cartoons. So kids would be like, oh, and then they'd pick up the VHS from the video store shelf, and they'd find out that it's oh, this is a bit more extreme than the cartoon. Well, that's how I've heard it.
I'll tell you what, just that reminds me of a little bit. When I was really, have you ever seen the film Sword and the Sorcerer? It was an 18 certificate. It's an old sort of fantasy film. And
yeah,
I think
so.
It was like a guy called the character called Talon. And I remember standing in line at the cinema with my mum, and I could only have been about 8 or 9 or something. And obviously my mum just saw the title Sword and the Sorcerer and assumed it was a kid's film. Yeah. And then we must have been standing there for ages, got to the front, and then I remember the guy coming out and saying, this is an 18, you can't come in. And I was like, oh. And I remember watching it, because I was born in 72, so I'm a lot older than you. So then I had this big collection of pre-cert videos and stuff. And I always remember seeing Sword and the Sorcerer for the first time, and thinking, Mum, how could you possibly think I was going to get in to see it? Because there's boobs and sex and blood and guts everywhere. It's but funny thing is, it's kind of down to my mum that I love horror films so much, because we used to record the double bills on I think it was a Friday or Saturday night on Channel 4 or possibly Channel 2. I think it was Channel 4, and there would be the Amicus and Hammer films, and we'd come down the next morning. And we'd watch them together. So that was some of my earliest memories of horror films. And then the Universals, they'd show on sort of Channel 2 as well, I think, 6 o'clock at night sometime. So my mum often says to me, it's my fault, isn't it? I was like, yeah. Sorry.
I remember when I was growing up as well, that it seemed to be one of those weird things where all the kind of really interesting weird cult films were always on either BBC Two or Channel 4.
That's it. Yeah. Exactly. I remember my first experience with The Wicker Man and Rocky Horror Show was recorded, and that when at the time I remember recording The Wicker Man, and it's obviously before the internet and stuff, so you don't you don't know anything when you're that age anyway. You know, you didn't have the internet, and you had a sort of a selection of books, but you know, they were very sort of obvious titles. You know, a lot about the Hammer films and things like that. And so I remember watching this film, The Wicker Man, and obviously recognizing people like Christopher Lee and Ingrid Pitt, and thinking, you know, obviously in these films that, you know, good always triumphs over evil, you know, because that's what happens in Hammer films. That's what happens
in the Hammer. Yeah, yeah.
And so I was just suspecting this Hammer film. All of a sudden, I was like, well, when's he going to get out of this? When's he going to get out? When's he going to get out of this big burning man? You know, and he didn't. And I was like watching this as a kid thinking, what the fuck? You know, whoa! I was like, what's going on? Well, you know, he hasn't just died, surely, because that doesn't happen in these films. You know, and then I remember another time watching, the Rocky Horror Show one morning, thinking, I don't know how old I was, but thinking, I don't know what's going on in this, because why have all the men got these clothes on? And I like, you know, that was one of my first sort of, I think, introductions to sort of to sex in the cinema, you know, and what a way, you know, what a way to start, you know. It's like, that was what video recorders did for us in the early 80s, you know. It's very, very strange, but great, you know. And I was actually talking about the Rocky Horror Show. I was really lucky, and I got to interview Richard O'Brien in London. It was just after Dark City came out with him in it, with was it Rufus Sewell? Yeah, I think it was. And that might be Melissa George as well, I can't remember. And that was great, because obviously I had that was a great lunch. And but the funny thing is, I was so naive. I was a student at the time. I didn't have any money. And so we got the bill, and he was expecting me to pay it because I was like the journalist, and I didn't have any money. And this was in like the Groucho Club in Soho. So it was like, you know, quite a well-known spot. Yeah, exactly. Jesus. So poor Richard had to buy not only his lunch, but mine as well. But then the funny thing is, well, we then got invited. It was me and another guy. And we then got invited to his party at one in Regent Street, the 10 room in Regent Street. It was a free bar, and I don't even know what happened at that party, because I woke up in Dartford, and that's all I remember by the train station. So I must have got the train somehow to Dartford. Don't know how, don't know why. Didn't need to know that, did you? But that's my Richard O'Brien story.
That's excellent.
Yeah, beautiful. He didn't talk to me after that.
No,
so,
no contact from 1998 until present day.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure he probably doesn't remember. There you go. So we've gone off on a tangent. I can't remember what we're talking about.
We're talking about your film, and we'll go back. I mean, I think we went through cartoons. Like, that's how we got here.
Cartoons.
That's how we got here. We started with cartoons. That's what this started tangent. And you were in discussions with Troma about getting some of their characters for some of the cartoon segments in the movie.
Yeah, and there's already a great an animated sequence in the film that my friend John Sellings did, who does a lot of stuff. He worked on like Doctor Sleep and War of the Worlds and stuff. He's done loads of stuff. So I was really lucky that he, you know, again, he's another person I kind of hoodwinked into helping. And his scenes, actually, it's really funny, but it's got a very dark, 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 nasty twist to it, which, again, I won't really mention. But it's about my love of, old children's TV shows, and how, you know, in the 70s, they were quite macabre, a lot of them, and there's a lot, you know, you go back and you look at some children's shows in the 70s, and there's some bizarre stuff, you know, really surreal kind of strangeness, some quite scary, you know, scary dramas, and then there's some really surreal stuff like Jamie the Magic Torch and stuff like that, and and this stuff I remember from childhood, and then sense of danger from some of them, which I kind of wanted to play with in this scene a little bit. So you get this sort of family watching this sequence that John's done, and it takes a twist. It's a bit, again, a bit Halloween 3 as well, because I'm a big Halloween 3 fan. So that was you know, another little influence.
You're talking about Marmite films.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And Halloween 3, it's a classic. I just absolutely love it. You know, Halloween is, obviously I've got Halloween top on at the moment, Halloween hoodie. Halloween, I think, is an amazing film. Halloween 2, I think, is a good, fun sequel. Very entertaining. Halloween 3 just blows me away. Every time I watch it, I just think it strikes the right chord. But like you say, there's a lot of people who don't like it. But I think a lot of people don't like it because Michael Myers isn't in it. I don't know.
Yeah, it does seem to be like, because a lot of people place it very highly in their Halloween rankings, or they place it like absolute last.
It's hard to place it anywhere, isn't it, within the Halloween rankings, because it's not, strictly speaking, a Halloween film. You know, it kind of needs to be placed separately almost. You know, it's hard to place it within that context, because it doesn't fit within that context, you know. But if I had to, it'd be definitely up there. I mean, you know, you know, Halloween 4 or 5, you know, something that's like, it's like, it is what it is. You're watching Michael for a reason. Like, you watch Jason for a reason. Like, you watch Freddy for a reason. You know, you know what you're going to get. Whereas Halloween 3 offers something totally different and actually quite original, you know. And it's not often as well in horror films where, you know, kids of that kind of age group are targeted as the main victims. You know, the younger kids, obviously, you know, the older teens are. But, you know, you're kind of playing with a lot of emotions with when you're targeting sort of 7, 8, 9 year olds, and you know, this guy wants all their heads to turn into mush and, you know, have snakes and centipedes come out. And that's pretty hardcore, you know. But it's done with such sort of panache as well that I don't know. It's a crazy, crazy film. Yeah. You know.
I think the biggest problem with that film, I quite like Halloween 3 as well. I think Tom Atkins' performance is great. I think the major downfall of that film, or maybe not the major downfall, but the biggest pitfall of watching that film, sticking that film on, is for about a week after, you'll have the Silver Shamrock theme stuck in your head. It just doesn't move.
Yeah.
You know.
I know. Absolutely agree. But you know, even that, it's that did 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 did. It's watching it on the screen, it's actually, I find it quite disturbing. I mean,
it is quite disturbing. Because you hear it so often throughout the film that you do start thinking, oh, I am going to go mad with this. You do start to crack up a little, and you're like,
oh, it's that repetition and the image flashing, and I don't know, I just think it's like such a well-crafted film. I understand why people were sort of pissed off about it, because they were expecting to see Michael, but as a film, Season of the Witch, blinding, you know, love it.
Anyway, going back to your film, I was going to say, like, because you're a first-time director, I know you've acted for a while and done, obviously, met a bunch of people, and but this being your first time directing, was it intimidating for you to direct all these people that you are a fan of?
Yeah, it was. It was pretty surreal. Especially someone, you know, yes, because all of a sudden, I mean, this is like the power of the internet, and all of a sudden you're talking to people who you've admired for years. You know, like Suspiria is such a fantastic film, and all of a sudden I'm talking to Barbara Manolfi, you know, and Lynn Lowry and all these people, and it was quite overwhelming, if I'm being honest. I kind of put my director's hat on, and I think because I've worked with, you know, some people before, I wasn't quite as starstruck as I might have been, but it was certainly an absolute thrill, you know, an absolute thrill to be chatting to Linnea Quigley. It's like I'm talking to Linnea Quigley here, you know. Return the Living Dead is another, you know, if you're talking about films that you come back to a lot. Return the Living Dead is definitely one of mine. Creepshow, you know, gone forever, but Return the Living Dead is one of those films I can put on all the time. So
It's a great film. Yeah.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's like the perfect horror film. It's like, again, like Creepshow, it's funny, but it's kind of scary at the same time. And I was like, you know, it's quite, you know, you feel for the characters, you're on the edge, you see, you know, you want, you know, it's just perfect. And
yeah, I would say, like, because it's definitely one of those films, like, because I often kind of make the differentiation between what I consider to be comedy horrors and horror comedies. And Return of the Living Dead is definitely a horror comedy as opposed to a comedy horror.
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying the emphasis is more on horror. Is that where you're?
Yes, that is my definition. That it's absolutely. Like, so yes, any film that is a horror film first and then and then has comedic elements would something like Return of the Living Dead would qualify as a horror comedy in my mind. Whereas something like Shaun of the Dead, I think that's a comedy film first and then has features horror tropes and stuff.
I think if comedy horror is very hard to do.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And horror comedy is very hard to do because they're two kind of genres that you think what do you make a horror film for? To scare people, to unnerve people, to terrify people. And then what do you make a comedy for? It's the opposite, isn't it? To make them feel happy, to make them laugh almost. So when you mash those together, they shouldn't sit easily together, maybe. I don't know.
You've
got to be really careful. I think in Witch of the Sands, there's definitely some comedic moment, but that comes through the characters and the scenarios and things. It's not written for laugh. You know, it's not a comedy horror. Definitely not. But there are some funny bits in it.
I think it's fine, a very difficult skill because you've got to strike the balance exactly right and you've got to create mark out very clearly to your audience what they are supposed to find scary and what they are supposed to find funny and not confuse the two and not have one thing that's scary in one scene and then funny two scenes later. That muddles things. So you've got to be very, very clear as to what you're doing and make it obvious to the audience what they're supposed to take seriously and what they're not supposed to take seriously.
Exactly. I mean, some of the best horror films, and there's still some funny moments, you know. Off the top of my head, Alien, for example, there's a couple of funny moments between the between the characters, you know, bits of anything that's quite entertaining. I can't think of any more. But you know, there's no reason that shouldn't work if the characters are in that moment where something funny's happening. That doesn't count.
If that's
well done, it shouldn't then detract from what's coming next.
Absolutely. And it's got to make sense. So, like, you know, you're talking about Alien, and it makes sense because it's kind of it makes sense within the characters they're playing, because essentially they're supposed to be like space truckers. And they're they're bantering as like, you know, like kind of blue collar workers, you know, like in space, you know. And so it still makes sense to the character in the situation.
Absolutely, and it's got to make sense. And like you say, I mean, I've seen so many comedy horrors that just aren't funny, and as a result, then they're also not scary. And you kind of end up thinking, why am I watching this? Because nothing's worth. This is the trouble. So I didn't set out to make anything funny, but some of the writing, some of the things, some of the stuff that sort of cropped up through certain situations that either Fisher or Tony, the director, finds himself in, is quite funny. I mean, Tony's a dick, you know, the director. He's a dick, and he acts like a dick. And some of the things he does watching are quite funny because he's just such a prat, you know. And Fisher, likewise, whereas Fisher's journey is kind of the other way around. He starts off as a prat, and then by the end of it, actually, he found more of a niche in life. Whereas, so Fisher, when he starts out, he's got this sort of crappy paranormal podcast. And as the film progresses, you find out that his name's Fisher Markway. You find out that the Markways, you know, his ancestors were these great witch hunters, or, you know, he kind of should have been. He was on the right track with his shitty podcast, but somewhere along the line, it slipped by him, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, he has these great ancestors, you know, these witch hunters, like and evil hunters and fighters. And he sort of found himself in the right area, a bit like Pete Venkman. You know, he's that kind of Pete Venkman bus Ghostbuster. You know, he's in the right area, but does he really know what he's doing? Not really, you know, but by the end of the film, he's exactly where he should be. And that's kind of Fisher's journey, really. Whereas the director, Tony's, he starts off as a dick. And by the end of it, he's unraveled, totally unraveled, without giving too much away. And that unraveling does cause, although quite horrible for him, some humour for people around him. And as a result, some for the audience, without me wanting to write it as a comedy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. So you were mentioning it's about halfway filmed. And obviously, you've been filming during this pandemic that we're all suffering from. And So, like, how has the filming process been done? Like, how are you dealing with everything that needs to be dealt with?
Yeah, so it's a good question. It's been really hard, actually, because I've just wanted to get it done, to get on with it. And, I don't want people to get impatient. So I've got two big scenes booked in. I'm doing a big druid scene on the 9th of May, which is going to be really fun, and lots of blood, and some music, and music that would be provided by Danny Thompson, who, I don't know if you know her, she's an actress, you know.
I am aware of her, because, like, you know, like, as we mentioned, I previously interviewed Alex Churchyard and Michael Holliday, and she's yes. in Ice Cream and Scream in the Beach.
And she's going to be in Mosaic, their next film as well, which I'm also in.
I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you about your role in that. But
Sorry, what was I saying? Yeah,
you were talking about the filming process and how you want to get done, and the big druid scene. Done.
Yeah, it's a big druid scene coming up, which is a kind of sacrifice. So that's another flashback. And then we've got a big kind of meta postmodern scene in the Whitstable Playhouse Theatre, which I've hired out for the night in July. That's going to be a big scene. Alex and Michael are in it, and there'll be a lot of independent sort of horror film actors and directors and producers stuff coming down to be in that with me, which is really cool. Pauline Piet from Satanic Rise of Dracula and Carry On Girls, she's in another scene, she's in that scene as well. And a lot of sort of horror film writers, book writers like Tris Thompson and Mark Banville, they're going to be there doing some bits and pieces. So we're filming it like the premiere. So again, so basically what happens is Tony's on the way to the premiere of The Witches of the Sands, because it gets all very complicated. So and Tony meets his match at this premiere, courtesy of Lynn Lowry, which is again really funny but quite unpleasant, and unexpected, hopefully. So that there's two big scenes, and I'm also doing I'm just about to start doing an Indiegogo campaign fundraiser, because I really, really, really want to hire. There's a Wild West town in Kent, in Longfield, called Laredo,
mm-hmm.
and then I think the trouble with being in lockdown is that where you can't do anything, you start thinking about the things you can do, And that obviously costs money. So I really want to, in one of the flashbacks, I really, really, really want to put a Wild West scene in. And I want it to be kind of Wild West meets Monster Squad kind of thing. So imagine one of Fisher's ancestors somehow in the States, gunslinging in a town with some ladies of the night and typical old timers, and then a lot of monsters, which I think would be really, really good fun.
Okay. I don't know why. I'm just like it. I've just suddenly thought of Tremors 4. Have you ever seen Tremors 4?
I don't know. I love the original. I kind of lost count on some of the sequels.
Yeah, there is one of the sequels. Tremors 4 takes place in the Old West, and it's like Burt Gummer's ancestor.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, how funny. Oh, I need to watch that. Because I love westerns. I love spaghetti westerns, you know, Franco Nero, Sergio Leone, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan, but I'm also like the kind of Americanized Young Guns and Tombstone and stuff like that. And I just think I'd just see a quick, even if it's only like a minute or two, just when Fisher's having one of his flashbacks to all these great imagine he has all these great ancestors. So there's a witch finder scene, there's this druid scene, there's I don't want to give too much away, but it's all these different scenes where you meet his ancestors in the past, and I just think one in the Wild West would be so cool, you know, with like a frontier town, dirt, dusty street, tumbleweed. I don't know, vampires and I don't know. and Fisher and his gang of evil hunters, you know, one with a bow and arrow, maybe a Native American in there as well, fighting on the side of the cowboy. I love that. But obviously that costs money. So I'm doing this Indiegogo campaign just to get that done, and then, you know, make it as good as I can post-production. I'd like to say luckily Alex and Michael from iScream are the great editors. They're editing for me after we get Mosaic done. There's a lot to do. I mean, I would have said about 5 months ago, I would have said it's about 75% filmed, but then all these silly ideas have popped into my head and as I'm only making one film, I kind of feel like I have to have them in there because I'm never going to get the chance to do it again.
This is the time to do it.
Yeah, this is now or never. So I will delay it for as long as I need to, you know, within reason to get that done. So that's kind of where I am. But obviously they're filming Mosaic for the moment. So yeah. Hopefully after that I'll have filmed and then we can edit. So that's kind of where we are.
And so is there a timeline? Is there a kind of date that you want it to be out by? Will we see it by 2022? Or?
This was my plan. I really love the Horror on Sea Festival in Essex.
Right.
And I would love to play it there the first time. Now, obviously, we're not going to get it done for 2022, but that would be January 23. So if I want to get it finished next year, without a shadow of a doubt, and get it in for Horror on Sea 2023. That would be my ideal, you know. And I can't see why it wouldn't be, you know. As long as I turn my brain off and don't keep thinking of anything else. I've told myself as well, I can't put any more in, you know, I can't just keep adding stuff to it. I don't even care how good the idea is or what I think, it's not going to happen. So as far as I'm concerned, we'll film up until whatever I've written down now is done, and then it will go to Alex and Michael, and then we'll get it edited. I've got some great music in it, actually. I should mention the music. I've got some great great tracks. Danny Thompson has donated two of her tracks from her album. A great New Zealand band, punk metal band called D Gruul. They put a track in. And some more local stuff. It's a really eclectic mix of music, but again, it works. There's sort of from John Carpenter inspired stuff. Fisher Marquo's theme tune is very Claudio Simonetti. It's a little bit demons-y. It's good, you know. So yeah, get all that mixed in, get it post-production, and then hopefully finish next year in time for Horror on Sea 2023. That's the plan, definitely.
Excellent. So I take it you've filmed your part in Mosaic. I understand Mosaic's.
No, I was gonna. I've got a couple of different parts. I'm playing the killer in just a mask. It could be anyone. But they said, "Do you want to do it?" I was like, "Yeah," because I've been a masked killer yet. In Striptease Massacre, which is set in space. But unfortunately, Danny couldn't make it to the shoot a couple of weeks ago. She was track and traced, you know, on COVID track and trace. So she had to isolate. Right. So they got some of it filmed. Didn't get that bit filmed. We're doing that on the 18th of April now. So I'll be playing the killer in that bit. But then my actual role, Mr. Daniels, which, okay, I don't want to talk about it too much. I don't know what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not.
Okay.
But I know but it's a great, I mean, I'm sure you know that it's an anthology film, and
I do know that it's an anthology film, and on a future episode I will be talking to Alex and Michael again.
Brilliant. So I've got to buy what I am excited, but I've got a scene with Simon Bamford, who played Butterball Cenobite in Hellraiser. So I'm going to fanboy out big time, and this, the actual segment of the film I'm in is called Fanboy, so it's kind of perfect, really. So I'm in the wraparound story, and I'm in my own separate story as well called Fanboy. So I'm really looking forward to that, because I loved Ice Cream on the Beach. I really, really enjoyed that. I love what they did with that. So I think Mosaic is going to be fantastic. I'm looking forward to working with them. And it's great that we can all work together, you know, and they can help me, and they're in my film, and a lot of people in that are in my film. And I cast a lady the day as a druid for my scene in May. And I happened to know that Alex and Mike needed someone of a similar age. So I suggested her, and they ended up casting her. So it's quite nice that we can help each other out. And so what I didn't realise, you know, until I started doing this and going to some of the smaller horror festivals, you know, is that there's such a network of independent filmmakers, you know, in the UK, you know, horror film. Yeah, I'm talking about, I mean, I don't know much about the rest, but, you know, everyone seems to know everyone. It's quite crazy. But everyone's very supportive, you know. And everyone's saying, you know, I think people probably know I don't really know what I'm doing.
I suppose people like meet each other at all these kind, because there is quite a few horror film festivals in the UK. I mean, up here in Scotland, we've got Dead by Dawn in Edinburgh. Yeah. We've got Glasgow Fright Fest, obviously in Glasgow. Yeah. And then obviously down south, there's Fright Fest in London, there's Grimfest in Manchester, there's, you know, Horror on Sea, there's, you know, like a whole bunch of various different festivals.
Yeah, I mean, I don't pretend to belong really in this group. You know, I'm a pretender to the, you know, I'm the first person to admit that I'm making a film and I don't really know how to make a film. You know, I'm doing what I've written and what I've directed and what I've acted in, I really like. But I kind of shouldn't be doing what I'm doing, if that makes sense, because I haven't gone through this process that I think other people have probably gone through, making, you know, lots of short films and learning and gone to film school, not even going to film school, but, you know, at least being in the situation where they kind of know more about the technical side of things. So in many respects, I kind of feel like a bit of a fraud.
I've talked to quite a few people who maybe have a more technical background. Maybe they started out as an editor, or they started out as a cinematographer, or they did this or that, or they started out in special effects, whatever it is. And I think that's a common kind of thing. Like, I think a lot of people feel like they're getting away with it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm the first to admit that without everyone's help, I mean everyone, I wouldn't be able to do it. I wouldn't know how to, you know. I wouldn't have got the results that I've got. But I suppose that's true of filmmaking to sort of kind of whatever level, isn't it? You have different departments doing different things and working together to create the one masterpiece. So I mean, I'll take that on board, and hopefully sort of my enthusiasm and love of horror is enough to make something that's worthwhile. That's kind of it, really. And I think it is, you know, I think I'm doing something that's got legs, you know, it's got a little bit of room to walk around, hobble maybe crawl a little bit, it'll be crawling towards a film festival near you soon.
That feels like an incredibly creepy image. I'm just imagining like a scene out The Ring now, you know, just like
don't give me any ideas.
I've got to have that one late 90s Japanese scene, you know.
Yeah, God, I haven't had that yet. God, I've got to have something pulling out of the TV. I haven't got a well. Yeah. Oh no.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. Before we go any further down this rabbit hole, Tony, that's we'll keep the film as it is.
I'll keep it at the 5 hours it is already.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it sounds full of interest and stuff, and it's certainly full of lots of known interesting faces from horror history, and yeah. I look forward to seeing it, and I'm sure my listeners will look forward to seeing it, and it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, Tony, and please do come back on again.
Oh, I'd love to, thank you. No, it's been really good. I do find talking about, you know, the film it's quite hard because it's changed so much and it's constantly evolving, which I like, you know, I really enjoy that, but it's hard to talk about and try and explain it to people, you know, in that it's nostalgic, but it's fresh, or, you know, it's funny, but it's quite unpleasant. Do you know what I mean? It's full of contradictions. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. And if it's crap, I'll blame Alex and Michael. So I'll say it's bloody edits. They didn't have the vision.
but
it's been great. Thank you very much for having me on. And you know, we'll talk again soon. Fingers crossed I can actually get this thing finished and filmed. Now we're coming out of lockdown finally. So
that was my guest Tony there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. I'd also like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. I really do deeply appreciate the support from every single one of you who take the time out to listen to the show. Remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you can make those reviews 5 stars, then that would be great. As according to the algorithm, anything less than that makes this show terrible. Yeah, I don't know either, but that's the way these things work in the modern world. Anyway, that's all for this time, but be sure to join me next week when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!